Welcome to the Zero Input Agriculture Podcast. Today, I have a guest, Samuel Lewis, who is the 21st century hoe farmer from Brittany, France. And I only recently stumbled onto the many YouTube videos that have done documentaries about his work and read his amazing self-published book about everything that he has achieved. And I think the title of his book says it all. He is the real deal. He is one of the few people I know who is actually producing not just a few vegetables, but a full diet of locally adapted crops, tapping into the deep agricultural history of the part of the world that he's living in. So I'll throw it over to you, Samuel, to tell me a bit more about yourself and how you ended up in this like very unusual position in life, and we'll take it from there.
Hi Shane. A bit about myself. Yeah, I like to call myself a subsistence gardener, self-publisher, an artist. And yeah, I'm 38, so starting to get old now, so yeah, I've got a lot of experience behind me, more and more. That's the advantage of getting older. But yeah, we're living out here in rural France, western western France. It's Brittany is a tradition of being slightly more independent from the rest of France. Celtic links. And came out here when I was 7 with my parents and sisters. So I've kind of grown up here.
And it's a kind of maritime climate there, if I'm guessing correctly.
It never gets really cold in winter. We're a good hour from the sea. So it's we don't have any salty winds. But yeah, it stays like mild. It never gets too hot in the summer, and it never gets too cold in the winter. It's kind of the same temperature, more or less. Damp and cold really all year round.
It sounds lovely. I've got Danish roots, and the few times I've been in those climates, my body's just gone, oh, I'm home, compared to the humidity and the mud and the droughts and everything that happens here in Australia. Let me think. So we talk about a couple of main topics, and the one I'm really curious to dig into with you is crop breeding, because your books and your documentaries that I've seen about you is very focused on techniques and methods and management. And I didn't see any little hint about like where you sourced your genetics from, and if you do any work to improve it or modify it as you grow it.
Crop breeding. Yeah, it always strikes me as something that would take several generations to really pull off successfully. I don't know if I'm right.
Well, there's some processes that can happen quickly, and but there's follow-on processes. And if you achieve something quickly and then you don't have several generations following it up, then did it really happen?
The thing is, here in France, in Europe, my logic it was that there were several crops that tried and tested and grow well here, been grown here for like a few thousand years. And so my logic was try and grow them to start off with. And then if I got good at growing them and could cover my basic needs, yeah, I'm always open to new crops. I've got a few friends that are very into crop breeding. They're trying to grow avocados and stuff. But I'm so if they give me some good seeds, I'll generally try them. I'm trying quinoa, which is traditionally a bit marginal for my area because it's a bit damp. But they've been breeding some varieties that are more adapted. So I will try them. I'm a little bit conservative when it comes to plants, because it's easy to life's quite short. Say you've got an adult life of active farming, it'd be good to 50 years, 55, 60 years. If you don't count your childhood, and by the time you get old you can't do much. And It just, yeah, it's easy to waste time on growing plants that don't or aren't adapted. And I think the important thing for me was, yeah, was to try and cover my basic needs.
I'm curious, where did you get your the material that ended up working for you? Like, where did you source those seeds? Is there remnant cultivation of those pre-industrial varieties accessible?
Sadly not. Sadly not. It was, yeah, everyone's, it's been one by one. Everyone's been a big adventure. You know, every new crop has been a really big adventure. And I think it's cereals that they really tampered with a lot. Because the thing, I grow like, I've got four, got five main crops plus vegetables. That's, you know, I've got, now I've got my cereal crops, which is rye, and I grow a bit of wheat, but wheat is poor, isn't so adapted to the Breton, the Brittany climate, so I've kind of abandoned wheat partly. So it's rye, wheat, buckwheat, potatoes, and beans, plus vegetables, and I do a rotation of 4 years, so every 4 years my crop will go back in the same field. And just finding that I could grow rye had been a big adventure because I think it was like 15 years ago I wanted to grow cereals because I thought growing vegetables just wasn't enough. You can have a glut in the summer, but here the winters are really long and you need to have stuff to that you can store. And so I was looking around for a cereal crop and I had wheat. You know, I had to grow wheat because I wanted to make my own bread. And I started growing wheat and it never worked for me. And people gave, you know, I had some friends working in the agricultural development and they seed breeding, they gave me different varieties and nothing worked because basically there's nobody's breeding anything for subsistence farmers. You know, you've got to do it yourself. And how long is it going to take? You know, but if anything from any lab, it's not going to be done for a subsistence farmer because there's no money in it.
I wonder if you should get on to someone like I interviewed Salvatore Ceccarelli in Italy. He was working in the Middle East and he's assembled these hyper diverse mixtures of staple crops like wheat. And then he's distributing them to farmers like you all across Europe to try them in different areas. And there's so much diversity in each variety that you can look for plants in that mix that perform well for you. It might be the like that final thing to bridge wheat from being marginal to being reliable enough to actually grow.
I know, but the problem that I've got is that when you're a bad farmer, you can have a good seed, but it still doesn't work for you. And I think this, you know, I have people that give me like 20 seeds, you know. That's 20 seeds of some, you know, rare wheat that they managed to get. And I put them in my soil and I can, you know, it's like last year, I mean, I've been growing rye now for 15 years. And last year, I had 3/4 of my crop eaten by slugs just as it was germinating. And I wasn't expecting it at all. But then I've only got 1/4 of the plants that I should have after 15 years. And because I know I mean, luckily, I had good luck with my rye in the early years. So I know it's the plant that works. But if I'd been trying it out, I'd have been thinking, my God, this is like is a terrible seed, or you know, this isn't the right stuff. And I think that's part of it, that because I'm a bad farmer, and I've definitely was a really bad farmer when I started out, and a bad farmer with zero knowledge and soil which isn't, you know, it's been completely not looked after. So it's like you know, you need to put nitrogen fertilizer on it or nothing grows. And obviously, I've been putting nothing on ever since I've got my farm. Everything's against you. And if you just put, you know, 20 seeds in the ground, and they don't work, it doesn't mean the seeds are bad. And so, yeah, you know, I think I started off with wheat and I still grow a bit of wheat. But there were so many things. There were so many things. One is that modern wheat variety, they've been bred to keep their seeds on the heads to withstand modern threat, the modern combine harvesters. But I thresh by hand with a flail. And if I, I can have a beautiful wheat, but I can't get it off of the heads. So it's just, it's to me, it's just a job. It's something that I definitely get into it if I could feed myself. I think the farmer's always getting, selecting better stuff just naturally. But at the moment, I'm still in the learning stage.
It's tricky with hedging your bets too. Like if you're trying something new, like you mentioned quinoa, someone can promise this variety is great, but I relate to this too because I do all of the work by hand. The amount of work it takes to set up a growing space, you can't afford to risk planting a huge amount of that new crop because there's a too high a chance that all of that work will go to waste. And the calculation that you go through, but I always leave a little bit of room for like just doing a small amount, but particularly some staple crops are scale dependent. So I'll often find if I plant like just one or two sunflowers, it's very easy for just a couple of birds to strip the entire crop. Whereas if I planted an acre of sunflowers, by the time I started seeing damage, I'd have different opportunities to deal. It just buffers out those impacts a little bit differently. And I was going to say too, with traditional agricultural societies, they had an accumulated knowledge of all of the variations that could happen. In Australia, for example, we go back and forth between a flood and drought about every 10 years. And I can grow a crop once and it does beautifully. And I'm like, okay, I've got it made. But then you realize, oh, I have to see how it's going to perform through all of those extremes. And until I really know how valuable it is in the long run to keep putting a bet on it.
Yeah, so here in Brittany, they basically for thousands, for at least a couple of thousand years or more, probably 3,000 years, there's evidence of them growing buckwheat, rye, and oats, and probably barley. And to me, it just makes so much sense to focus on those crops, because at least, even if you've got modern, I mean, I got modern varieties because the old varieties are basically lost. Obviously, now I'm doing it and people know that I'm growing cereals. I get funny people coming from all over with a few seeds and they say, this is an old variety. That's an advantage of being known. And now, as you said, if I just planted two seeds, the birds would get them, but I'm already growing 600 square meters of rye. I can easily put one row of naked barley or something in my field and it won't suffer the same bird attack. So I've got a base now of something that works, but I started off with modern varieties, but I have discovered I think that rye seems to have been a lot less tampered with than wheat, and so my rye crop is quite a rustic variety, and that's my main crop.
I'm curious, do you have to worry about ergot, the fungus in your rye, given you're in a fairly wet climate?
It the first year I grew it with my Boughton seed, I had a small amount, and I thought this is terrible. I looked it up on the internet, and apparently, I had even in what I thought was a lot, I had less than the official sellable limit for rye
Oh no.
in commercially. I got like two small pots of ergot. And then somebody advised me to plant it a bit earlier. The later you plant rye is the more ergot it gets because of the ergot mushroom has the cycle where it spores, but so yeah, now I plant it around end of September, beginning of October. And I think most year they get none at all. The thing is, it's really easy to see because the ergot grains turn into big black banana things. They're like five times as big as a rye grain, but I've only had one or two.
And I'm guessing too, because you're hand processing it, you would see it as you go, like you're constantly assessing. So the chance of much of it getting into the final food is reduced to compared to a combine harvester just going at high speed.
Exactly. I cut it by hand, so I'm looking out for ergot. It's I'm threshing it by hand, I'm winnowing it by hand, and I'm milling it by hand. So that's four stages where I can sort my ergot. But apparently, five or six ergots in your bread isn't going to, not in one loaf of bread, but five or six ergots in a bag isn't going to kill you.
I'm curious too, now that you mentioned that you're doing a lot of that processing of grain yourself, and you're dealing with multiple different like species, and you're also probably digging into like the history of how it was done in your area before industrialization. Am I right in thinking that centralization of grain processing is much older than people realize? This idea that every little farm was grinding their own flour is it probably wasn't that way, that there was like a central windmill or watermill or animal mill. There was a concentration of resources in that processing technology between different farms and families.
I think there was a certain amount of exchange. I mean, funnily enough, the Romans got into the watermills, which is quite centralized. And pre-Roman, they had a lot of handmills, something that I know in Scotland, the English came and they broke the handmills of the Scottish peasants, because if you as a farmer, the farmer was taxed on their grain, and if the farmer was grinding their grain in their house, you couldn't tax. You didn't know how much they had grown, and if you had to take it to the mill, it was the miller who could be the tax man. And that's why the aristocrats didn't want peasants to have stone mills in their farms. And the Bretons, buckwheat, one reason why buckwheat is a very popular crop in Brittany is because it's a softer grain and you can mill it without, on like a, they have these wooden mills, which they're like two rotating pieces of wood with like metal like nails inserted into the wood. And that's what mills the buckwheat. It's not strong enough for wheat, but it's strong enough for buckwheat. So the Bretons got into growing buckwheat because they could mill it in their home, and so they weren't taxed.
It was one of the reasons why the potato was so transformative when it took off in Europe, that it was pretty much impossible to tax it. Interesting. I'm trying to think if there's anything else on the crop breeding side of things. I know you're also working with some staple tree crops and fruit trees. Are you doing any selection from like the local population, and then when the trees grow, applying any pressure to them?
The thing is, there are a lot of old varieties. My general belief is that what is old, in plant and farming, what is old is good, because it's tried and tested. And until we've mastered and refound what we've lost, how can we move forward? And so, here we've got lots of old, we've got lots of old apple trees, which are probably a couple of hundred years old, which I do my own grafting, so I'll go and I'll collect the branches and I'll try and get these old varieties. But yeah, I just don't think that we understand enough about farming to be able to breed intelligently today.
Yeah, I can understand that position. And yeah, as I said before we started, I'm is it envious or jealous? I always mix them up. But I'm in strong admiration of the position that you're in a part of the world that has a pre-industrial agriculture that was thriving up until relatively recently. And it's just very interesting to hear that even with the work that you're doing, it's very difficult to find that pre-industrial genetics. And it's kind of the tragedy of our age, isn't it? There's like thousands of years of trials and selection and tradition were just thrown away so casually. And picking up those threads is, I mean, it's a very special calling, particularly given that we might be heading into a time where we need to, reclaim that power, that ability to look after ourselves.
I know, and seeds are terrible because they'll lose. I mean, here in Brittany, it's probably only been 70 years since people have been growing these ancient varieties, but everything's been lost just in 70 years. And you can go to a second-hand market and get yourself an old flail, which was used to thresh one of these grains. But the variety of grain that could be threshed with it has disappeared. And it's like wood and metal that stayed, but it seems the plant world is so fragile. I mean, the tree is the same. You can have a 100-year-old apple tree and still collect the variety. But with wheat or cereal, you need to grow it every year, more or less, to keep it alive. And, grow it every year by hand and eat it. There's been no, continuity like that here at all. Everything's been lost. So really, we're in the same boat as you.
You've just got the specter that it is possible. I'm like grasping at ghosts. Well, not even ghosts, like just complete theories. Well, let me ask the question now that I normally save to the end, because I want to focus on this. But if you could create any crop, if you had unlimited resources and you're going to live for 1,000 years, or you could just wave a magic wand and like have it in your hand, ready to go, what crop would you find most interesting to like create? Like, is it filling a gap in your system, or is it something more fanciful?
Well, actually, to be practical, because I could say anything I could say, but to be practical, what I would really love, is a variety of oat that I could eat. And just, to share this with you, seeing you've got an audience and somebody might have an answer, is that oats are a really staple crop, they have been a really staple crop for a large part of the world. They're the most beautiful crop to grow. They just grow by themselves, and but they're in a husk. The oat grain is in a husk, and you can't get the husk off. And you can grind it, but because the grain itself is soft, it sort of shreds up instead of being milled into flour, and so it mixes up with the husk. So even with a sieve, you can't separate it from the husk because the husk, grinds up, and the grain grinds up, and the husk is really sharp, so it just pricks into your gums. And there are varieties of naked oats, but they're not all naked. Nobody knows this because everybody's, oh, I'll grow myself rolled oats, I'll grow myself oats and roll them, and but you can't get the husk off. But nobody knows because they've got some such good mechanical processes for getting the husk off
It's the
that
it's
you've
those
been eating.
steam rollers from like the industrial age kind of transformed that crop.
Exactly, and some way of rubbing off the husk. And I mean, I'd even buy a machine if it was a reasonably priced and small scale, but I found no small scale machine for de-husking oats, affordable small. And so this beautiful plant, and it's no problem growing it. If I could grow it, it could just be happy as the day is long. It takes no work. But I can't. So yeah, it would be a huskless, a really huskless oat would be my magic crop.
There's a really interesting story about oats that I don't know if you know about it, but when like wheat and barley were domesticated in the Middle East, oat came along for the ride as a wheat, sorry, as a weed. So when they were growing wheat and barley, they were constantly having to fight to like stop the oats from like taking over. And when that package of species went into northeastern Europe, it was so wet and like damp and horrible that in places like where you are, wheat and barley were kind of marginal. They didn't grow that well. But the oats, which had been like a pain all along, came to the fore. They're like, oh, we love it here. And they're not as easy to deal with culturally, but at least they grow. So the culture shifted to like figure out how to deal with this horrible weed that actually wanted to grow when the wheat and the barley wouldn't. And they figured out complicated ways of turning it into something like bread and gruel. But yeah, it's just interesting that it's something that was always a problem, and then it became a salvation for cultures that were outside of the original climate zone.
Yeah, that is an interesting story, and I think that they must have it must have been quite a manual process, I think, de-hulling it. But I still don't. You still can't. I still can't find on the internet how they did it. You can tap and tap away, and there's a lot of information about celebrities and pages and pages and pages. And I think it's like, a tiny paragraph or notes that just oversimplifies it, and it just doesn't work. It's like, well, yeah, great idea, but artificial intelligence comes up with a great way of doing it, but you try it out and it doesn't work, but that would definitely be my magic crop.
I feel your pain because just the other day I wrote this up on my Substack. I did an experiment with a relative of foxtail millet, because it grows as a perennial here, and I'm looking for ways of using it. And it has reports of it being used as a staple grain, and it grows really well. I'm like, okay, I'm going to harvest some, and I was doing all of these like probably very laughable, comical experiments to try and figure out how to make it edible in the kitchen on a really small scale. But it was promising enough that I'm going to pursue it. I might have to do some breeding work with it to hybridize it with foxtail millet and turn it into something at least a little bit better.
Is millet in a husk as well?
A little bit, but it's relatively easy to remove with simple technology. I think it's one of the reasons it was one of the first grains that spread in various areas.
Have you tried dehusking it yourself?
I'm trying to think. No, when I was first growing foxtail millet, the birds, and we've got so many birds here in Australia, just completely shredded it before it had even matured. Whereas this weedy kind of millet relative doesn't have quite the same problems. So I'm hopeful that I can strike a balance there with something that's a bit more edible but still bird resistant.
And does it have a husk, this wild one?
I think it's got a very thin husk. So you can just grind the whole thing up into gruel, and it's a little bit fibrous, but it's quite soft to do
Okay.
that grinding at least. So I think it's at the status of famine food at the moment. But I mean, sometimes, again, traditional agricultural systems in your area, is there still a connection to the wild foods, particularly the staple crops, that acted as a backup when all of the grain crops failed for a year?
Interesting question. I do think, I mean, people talk a lot about foraging these days, and I do think that the farmer did a lot more foraging than what we imagine. And I mean, I say to people, if you are, if you like foraging, the ideal environment to forage in is the farm, is a subsistence garden, because, just on the hedgerows beside your fields and everything, you've got such a diversity of plants. But I don't think we're in one of the best areas in the world for human survival. Because thinking of roots and nuts, our main nut is acorn, which isn't terribly edible. And we don't have a lot of roots that are really that edible either. So I think people would have been living more on meat in the past if they hadn't had farming, personally. But it's a great climate for animals, you've got a lot of grass growth.
And it's a really good climate for storing processed dairy as well, isn't it? It's just cold enough that during the harder times of the year, with relatively simple technology, I think you can ferment and make cheese and keep it.
It's great for storage. It's in the winter, it's for vegetables as well. It's a great not too cold, but not too hot either. I store most of my stuff outside in these outdoor storage clamps, and just do it with straw and earth, and it just saves space in the building. So I don't have to store them indoors.
I work a lot on storage crops here, but it's so different with the humidity and the warmth that you really have to look for particular strains of things like a pumpkin that can sit around in those conditions. Whereas a lot of the temperate varieties that are bred for storage, you try and do it here, and they're just like, no, it's a sauna for a lot of the year. So it's a different challenge.
It's interesting though, because I had an aunt who's moved to Flinders Island, and I've been talking to her about agriculture, and she was telling me of all the different pests that attack these crops if you want to have a garden. And I never really thought about it like that before, and I thought, yeah, in Europe we've just killed them all. I think over the past 5 or 6,000 years, we've just eliminated, I think, all the things that really make farming impossible. And I just take that for granted. You know that actually the flora and fauna basically co-evolved with human beings for the past several thousand years. And the things that actually make life completely impossible, we've basically eliminated. You know, the woolly mammoths as well that could like trample over my trample over my crops. And I take it for it is how, yeah, how you can take for granted the work of people in the past. And it seems that yeah, in parts of Australia, you've got that wildlife that it hasn't been sort of evolved with farming.
I had a family of kangaroos in my garden the other day. Like, I think there was five of them, and I went out this morning and there's like bounce prints through a freshly sowed bed of veggies. So I'm like, oh, hopefully they'll come through, but I might need to resow some of them. And we've got a little creature like a large rabbit that's kind of an omnivore, and a lot of the root crops just get destroyed by them. They just dig up and eat everything, even high cyanide strains of cassava. They grow okay here, but then as soon as they start filling out, they just get destroyed by the wildlife. And grains, we've got parrots and finches like coming out of our ears. But I have managed to breed a parrot-resistant strain of white maize. So when it's not flooding or a drought, I can grow that. I can at least get it past the animals.
Yeah, it's another world.
Okay, now let's move on to the thing that I think you're most famous for, how you manage to grow with low inputs. Because I think we're on very similar mindsets here. Basically, we're trying to develop farming systems that if you couldn't get hoses and pumps and fertilizer and pesticides, you would still be able to produce some food
Yeah.
just from the land and the plants and the techniques. So tell us how you came into finding that to be a priority. Like, why did you decide that was something you really wanted to do?
And it's funny, really. To me, it's always seemed logical. You know, the way I look at the world, ever since I've been really tiny, that I have to be able to be autonomous. You know, obviously, when you're a kid, you're not autonomous, but you think, when I grow up, I'm going to be a self-sustaining unit. You know, that's what being an adult is. It's having a certain degree. You know, that's what freedom is as well, having a certain degree of autonomy. And, be able to see something through from the beginning to the end. And as well as that, I think I've decided that it gives me more pleasure when I can follow something through from the beginning to the end than if I just do one of the steps in the process. And I also don't like shopping, but it's partially because I'm just helping to fuel an economy which isn't a positive economy. It's this idea of a virtuous cycle, you know, that you put something in and it just gets better and better, you know. So it always seemed completely logical that I'd have to I don't want to be dependent on something that in the end is negative for the overall it's like the human being today. We're just a contradiction because we need food to live. But to get the food, we need to poison the soil, which creates the soil infertile so we can't live on it. And same with a house, you know, we want to live somewhere, so we come in with a bulldozer and concrete to destroy the bit of land we've just bought. And we can live in it, but we can't survive in it because, you know, we've created it inert. And it's like inherent contradictions. And you know, I think when I was young, I thought that was normal. I think I can see why I felt weird because I thought that was normal, that a human being was a, you know, an incomplete creature. And then you look back a few thousand years and you think it isn't the case. This is just a recent phenomenon. All this stuff that they're telling me I need, do I really need it? And that really applies to farming. And it seems that when you're actually doing, you know, you start thinking about it. Obviously, if you're growing a crop and shipping it out and selling it, and people are just giving you money, you're going to have a deficit on your land. So you're going to have to buy something in because you can't put the money on the soil But if you're just growing it for your own consumption, nothing leaves. And so it was more that, yeah, it was more of an idea that it was going to be possible, which backed up this, dislike of going out and shopping for something. That made me think the cause was more important than the crop. I thought, I know that I'm going to lose my crops because I'm not going to buy in a plastic net, or I'm not going to, but at least my garden will be beautiful. And funnily enough, although I do lose crops, to this and that, I've always had enough to eat really from my garden. But yeah, I mean, I'm really for zero input, I'm a real radical zero inputter. I think I'm the most radical. That's why the name of your podcast is really, I thought this is amazing that someone actually come up with this concept. In French, you call it zero entrant, and I didn't really know what the English equivalent was. But obviously, if you don't have anything
There's a
to.
movement in India starting as well called zero budget farming for like the poorest of the poor farmers, showing them that they don't have to go into debt to buy a bag of fertilizer to like have a chance of making a living. And I think it's starting to catch on. People are realizing that it's a trap to like have to start behind to even have a chance of growing anything.
Yeah, but I mean the budget's different, isn't it? Because people, I've got neighbours, and they say, "Oh, I use plastic, but it's all second hand." But to me, as I said, I'm a radical. It's still input. And no, it was more of an experiment. I thought, if I don't put anything on, if nothing goes out, I don't need to put anything on. And saying that the sunlight falls on my farm for free. And I've also got water in the springs and from the rainwater. Then basically, my farm's getting, I mean, obviously, it's getting input from the sun and it's getting input from the water, but it's not going to, it shouldn't, why does it need to get stuff from outside? And so, yeah, I don't have, because here they grow a lot of stuff under plastic because it's a bit damp and cold. But I don't. I used to have a polytunnel, but I don't anymore. I do all direct sowings, which means I don't need to buy in potting compost or pots. And yeah, I think the only real input I've got is my tools, my metal tools.
It's interesting you mentioned that because, and going back to your point about this human capacity for independence, a lot of modern culture looks back on the pre-industrial like peasant times and casts them as slaves, as being these like desperate, powerless people who, the kings and the knights would just kick around. And that wasn't the case at all. Like the kings were hanging on for dear life to not piss off the peasants, because they didn't even know what the peasants were up to. Like even being aware of what was happening in all these little villages was a challenge for the nobles. But the thing that tied them together was iron and salt. The peasants had that dependency to get good quality tools to like make them more efficient, and they brought salt in from the salt trade for, I think, ultimately mostly nutrition, particularly if you're living away from the ocean. It's easier to maintain good health if you get some sea minerals coming in. But it was a relatively stable balance of power between that mass of peasants and a really small elite kind of holding it all together. But then when you look at how it's arranged today, it's just so different. And that transition must have been so disorienting to go through. And then I think we're both on the same page that there could be a similar reverse transition some point in the future, that the bulk of people may be forced to go back to providing their own needs again at some point. And yeah, I don't know. Is that kind of resonating with you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, if there is a future, it's a future with, growing stuff on the land without input. To me, that, maybe that isn't our future, but if that isn't our future, then we don't have one. Because that's the way I view it, that is the only future. And what we're living here is just a tiny sort of hiatus. Of something that doesn't, a negative cycle where we're just polluting polluting and toxifying more and more things at a frightening rate in just the course of a few years, and it's got absolutely no chance of continuing in a sustainable way. We've got no chance of resolving the problems that we're creating.
And counterpoint, do you think there's anything that we can do today in this like crazy industrial age that has the potential for long-lasting beneficial impacts? Like after this has all come and gone and the world's gotten simpler again, are there things we can do now that we have so many, like look at us now, we're speaking to each other from the opposite sides of the world. Is there some good to be taken out of all of this kind of crazy time that we can like pass on to future generations?
An example that didn't work. That's what I think sometimes. I looked at reading about, some of these African societies, and it's quite funny because most cultures, they have some story like of the Great Flood, Noah's Ark and stuff, and yeah, well, these are African Bantu tribes that had the same story, and they had the tribal law is that no inventions. What was the idea with that? What was used, for the ancestors is good, should be, it was good enough for us. And to innovate was disrespect and was punishable by death. And to me, that's an incredible, and then Europeans come and say the Africans are primitive. But actually, is it can be explained by this very strong tribal law that, to innovate doesn't work in the long run. And that's inc I thought that's an incredible, powerful collective wisdom from the past that it doesn't work, And I think, yeah, so this is what I'm often think. I think, my God, we're going to leave a great collective memory here, not to go down our road again.
I mean, the Amish are the only example I can think of a culture that at least tries to make those decisions collectively. They like look at each technology and try and figure out whether it's actually going to work for them or not. And they don't get caught into that kind of runaway process where everyone just gets dragged into doing something, whether they really want to or not. Like a lot of young people today, if you're the only person who doesn't have a mobile phone, then you get like left out of every social activity. Whereas if nobody had them, people would use other means for organizing them, and nobody would be penalized. So it's this kind of it's this
Peer pressure.
yeah, it's this kind of tragedy of the commons. That can happen through technology as well.
I know, I think I was lucky when I was a kid. I was home educated and I didn't have any friends. And it's kind of funny because the thing that everybody would, all the adults would say to me, "Oh, you're being home educated. Do you have any friends?" And I was like, "Well, no, I don't, because I find other little boys that are aggressive and violent and I don't want them to kill me. So I'm hiding from them." But I think that growing up, I can see that friends just hold you back, because you want to do the same as them. But when society's mad, your friends are mad. And so how much do they help you trying to be like your friends?
It's another thing I can be envious about. I wish I could have been homeschooled because I was in survival mode to get through the school day, dreaming about going home to my garden and just being alone in my garden or in my greenhouses.
That is so sad. That is so sad having to be exiled. When I learned to drive, I had to go and leave my farm. But I was like 18, and I just thought this is nuts. It was like exile from my land. I have to go and sit in a classroom to learn about, highway code. And I just thought, imagine if that had been my every day at school. What a tragedy.
Well, that's one thing that we can segue onto. So you were lucky to be homeschooled, and that culture is growing and spreading like all over the Western world at a rate which I think is alarming the education departments that believe that it's their responsibility to program the brains of the next generation. And I believe you've done some work with you and your brother on homeschool education resources. Do you want to talk briefly about that? I haven't looked into it much, but I saw it and I was very curious.
Yes, my dad actually, my daddy wrote the book. We did it together, but I've got two sisters, my dad. And the thing is, he wrote two books on home education, and we illustrated them as part of our lessons, really, when we were I was 11, I think. My sisters were a bit older, and we sold them in the UK. I've got a huge bumblebee in here, so that's what the noise is. It seems to have woken up. And it was so we did a couple of books on home education, which we sold in the UK. And but they weren't really making enough money, so we abandoned the whole project a bit after a bit. But and then you get these questions. I mean, you get these secondary questions of you can home educate your kid, but what are you going to teach them, and what world are you going to share with them? And I think for me, it's the that's where the subsistence garden, really comes into it, is that it's such a beautiful place, for life, for a kid, but also you can see life just thrives. It's not like a city, You see your bird, the birds thriving, the bees and the insects thriving, life thrives. But that kind of puts to me that I don't have kids, not yet. But I think another thing I was paranoid about, how could I have kids if I didn't have a sort of a beautiful garden in which they could grow in?
That's one thing I loved in your 21st century hoe farming book. You pointed out that modern farms are like terrifying, hideously dangerous places for children. I mean, they're bad enough for the adults that have to work among the machinery and the chemicals and this landscape that it's usually turned into. Whereas a pre-industrial subsistence garden is a relatively safe place for young people to be. And it's another advantage of getting them involved with it.
I know it's crazy because I mean, obviously the modern farms and the workplace, it's like they're bad for birds, they're bad for wildflowers. It's like they're bad for it, then we forget that we're just part of the rest of life. And if it's bad for the birds and the flowers, then it's obviously going to be bad for us. And we can't like the tra that's the tragedy of it, really, that we're actually doing it. We're the biggest losers, and I like to say that to people. It's like, well, Nate, you don't need to save nature. Nature's okay. Nature will outlive you. Nature will adapt. It's you that you're killing. We're killing ourselves. We're the only big losers. We're the ones that are going to sort of disappear, permanently if we continue the way we're behaving.
How was your experience with producing the 21st century hoe farming book? Because you took a different route. I think a lot of people these days, myself included, put a book together and just put it on Amazon and kind of crossed our fingers. But you took it into your own hands. Like you've done more of the actual production process and the distribution process. Do you want to just tell me briefly about that and how it worked out for you?
Yeah, I mean that's I'm interested in my farm, but I'm interested in you're talking about virtuous cycles, and zero input. I think it's something that applies to the whole of your life. Is that the more you can manage your process from start to finish, the more pleasure you get out of it, and also trying to make sure that it had a positive impact rather than a negative impact. Example, putting it on Amazon. I haven't got, I'm not someone with anything specific against Amazon, but it's still you're contributing to it's very, very big impersonal business, and I think I brought the same philosophy as we did with the farm to trying to have a publishing business. So what my dad wrote the book. And we obviously were in France, so it was in English, and so we had a friend who volunteered to translate it, and we drew it. I drew the pictures, and then we printed it on our home printer. And at the start, we only he just wanted he had a market stall. He just wanted 10 copies for his market stall. We had no idea of how to sell it. So we put 10 copies on his market stall. Then I did another 10 copies in a cafe, which I knew, and they had it. And it's hard. I think, yeah, I ended up putting it in two or three different cafes. And then it's hard to really remember how it started getting better known, but it was very, very slow in the early days. I think for the first 2 or 3 years, it really didn't do a lot. But everybody that read it liked it. That's my bumblebee.
I see.
It's my new pet. And it's yeah, I think it's I'm a big believer in local, you know. I'm a big believer in local. And I think yeah, by having a started getting known locally, and then obviously because it was local, I could combine it with garden visits. And everybody likes to visit a beautiful garden. And they're actually, a lot of people travel a lot, so they come and visit the garden and they'll take the book off to the other side of the world and then somebody else will see it. And so it's happened very organically. And this is why, even though sometimes I think, it'd be nice to speed it up a bit and get better known, it'd be nice just to wait and see how it develops, with people like you and stuff.
Well,
That's what's
I
really
found
interesting.
you, and I think if you'd been on Amazon, I wouldn't have found you any faster.
No, and I don't know. I'm having difficulties with my postal tariffs at the moment, and 'cause I had a really cheap book rate all over the world, and they're stopping it in a couple of months.
I got
That's
in
mean
just
that
in time.
postage is going to go like it's going to go to like 16 euros or something just for a book, one book. They're about the same as Australian dollars, I think, aren't the euros. I'm on just six at the moment. I hate, it's stupid when the postage costs more than the book. So I'm just, I'm wondering, maybe exactly. I'm thinking Amazon print on demand. I'm thinking of an e-version. I don't know. The important thing is to get it out there and to keep it human. I don't, I think I don't want to pay anybody, I think it's nice when it's human. When you go in human, there's no more pleasure in it. This is what I can't understand about the farmers is that, but they're not enjoying themselves. It's like if at some point you could say, "Well, I'm making money, but I'm not enjoying myself." It's like this idea that you suffer in your job and then you have your holiday. But your work should be your holiday. You should be enjoying it. And it's like we've put these tasks in it, which often, yeah, it's thanks to these external things they're bringing in. That nobody enjoys driving around their field in a tractor. It's boring. And
It's
it
boring
yeah,
when
it's
the
the same
tractor
with
works, and it's frustrating when the tractor's broken.
it's very frustrating when the tractor's broken, exactly. And that's for me, that's where I went on to hand tools, really. I started off with a rotavator and I had a petrol size mower. But every time it broke down, I didn't want to be repairing it in the shed. I just wanted to I got my hand tool at my size and I started cutting the grass. And it was like, well, at least I'm enjoying myself. I'm going slower, but I'm enjoying myself.
Do you find with machinery too that it's easier to make bigger mistakes faster?
Yeah.
Like you often think you need to do something, and then the machine just waves a magic wand, and there you go. And you're like, oh no, I really wish I'd done a little bit of that first and then seen the result before I committed to doing all of it.
Yeah. I mean that's so much the case, and it's you can see it on a world scale. It's just terrible, with charging of this sort of confidence, and it's like we see what we're doing. And then the problem when you have a machine in your own place, because you did it with a machine, you just think, oh, I can't put it back by hand, and that's what I got. Years ago, I got a mini digger in, and I to get a rock out, and then I thought I'd make a bank, a hedgerow with it. Oh, I was so happy making my hedgerow, but actually, it's not what I wanted. It was in the wrong place, the wrong thing, and I took it all down by hand. And I thought, the fitting way to learn from my mistakes, because it takes what you can do in a day might take you 2 weeks by hand, but
I'm curious as well, quality hand tools in your part of the world. Like a lot of the, a lot of people who are thinking, oh, I'll start doing more like handwork in my garden. I want to go down this path. And they just buy whatever tools they can get. And they're often like dreadful. Like they're barely usable at all. And I was lucky I managed to find like a refurbished, I don't know where this thing came from. It's my favorite tool on the whole farm, this hoe that is just like an extension of my body now. And I lost it once for months in the undergrowth, and I was distraught. I was just like going to give up on everything. And I found it eventually. But how do you solve that problem in your part of the world?
Well, we're quite lucky to have, because we're in a rural, quite a rural area. We're quite lucky to have a garden centre which caters for farmers. And the basic farming tools, which for me are a scythe, no, a hoe, a sickle, which is like a sickle is like a really old tool. You know what a sickle is?
I use Japanese sickles, Kamas, with the little curved serrated blade, and that's my second most favorite tool.
But basically, it's like a sickle moon shape out of metal, and that's for cutting. I use that for cutting my cereals and cutting grass on my hedgerows and stuff, and brambles. And yeah, the hoe, the sickle, the bill hook, which is like a sickle but a bit thicker metal, and it's for wood, cutting wood, and the scythe, which I use for cutting grass. So all these four tools were all sold in my local garden centre. And that's actually how I discovered them. Later, I discovered that they're just really poor quality versions. But that, you know, because the metal, it's pressed, it's not forged, so it's just the hard to sharpen, or else the hoe just like wears away really fast. But there's still the basic tools. And interesting, I think it's a problem everywhere that you can't get these basic. I mean, I call them like the basic. Peasant tools, it's like what we don't want to the hedge trimmer, just you definitely don't want your petrol tools. You don't want a strimmer. Our strimmer's been sitting there, for 15 years untouched. But you don't want to, a hedge trimmer. You can cut a hedge with a sickle, Don't want a hedge trimmer. Nothing with these plastic handles, Anything that's complicated, you just want something with a head and a handle that you can put together yourself. And when it breaks, you can mend it. And this is, it is an input, but your hoe head can last you 10 years. You could, forge it from a bit of scrap metal, and the hoe you made yourself, and the handle you made yourself. But yes, I mean, that's the basic thing about these tools. But yeah, I had a friend in France. There was a had a friend like about 4 years ago who started a tool shop just for these, basic peasant tools, which he mainly imports from Italy because he's found one. I mean, in Europe, there are only two traditional scythe makers in the whole of Europe, one in Austria, one in Italy. So there aren't a lot of them here. But anyway, he decided he wanted to source them, and he's actually done really well. So I've been saying that to other people that contact me. I'm saying, because he only exports in France and a few other European countries, it's a good opening because I think, it's, just for a small urban garden, they're actually much, much better tools. And, we've just been the cheaper and the more efficient, and people don't know about them.
They're a lot more ergonomic too once you know how to use your body with them. Whereas a lot of these mechanical things, particularly the strimmers, you're like leaning sideways and vibrating the whole time. And
It's just disgusting, yeah.
even if it only takes a tenth as long, it's so hard on your body for those, that tenth that you're being shaken around by the machine.
I know, and you can't make a strimmer on the farm, can you?
No.
This is the thing. You can't make a strimmer on the farm, and even if you could, you couldn't get the petrol. And so this is why, my tool is an input, but it's a very, very simple input compared to these complicated machines. And if you're growing for yourself, you don't need them. That's the thing. All the machines are just there to facilitate you to grow for others.
And if you've got a beautiful garden, you actually enjoy spending the time out working in it too. It's not a punishment, it's actually the highlight of your day.
Exactly.
We should probably move on to the final main thing I like to talk about. And we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but I like to talk about how people connect with others, the social connections that they build around the low input farming that you're doing, and how you hope to pass on that work and that knowledge to other people. Because like you're kind of like the first little stitch in this pattern that you've had to do so much of this hard work on your own, figuring it out. And it would be a real shame if that, leads to nothing, and then the next person has to start from scratch again.
Yeah, I think I definitely feel I'm going in a direction, and I'm not sure where it's going to end. But I think I spent about 15 years just hammering my head against the wall trying to farm, to see if it worked, to see if nature said, "Yeah, you belong to us," or "You don't." And that's a very personal experience. And then, quite naturally, yeah, we thought, me and my dad, and we thought, let's do a book to share. And then I've done a few more cartoon books to follow on, because I tend to do it in drawing. But so I did these books, and then I've, recently I've been having a bit of recognition for them, and I think, well, that's great, but actually, what do I want? It's not money. You sell the book, you get a pile, you get 10 euros or something. It's like, well, that's, if I wanted money, I'd find an easier way to get some money than doing these books. So it's obviously not money. And I think at the moment, yes, people that are interested, I'd like them to, I'd like to be able, to share with them on a deeper level, what what I've learnt. Which is sometimes it's not easy to work out really what you have learned, because it doesn't just come down to the crops or the specific knowledge. It kind of comes down to an ethic, a work ethic, a joy of being outside, And yeah, so my latest, I think the natural development of the books is that is courses. Because I'm radical, I want to do free courses. Because I do, I do zero input farming. So if some, no one's going to make any money from my, zero input, zero output is what I really do. I don't think people should sell, and therefore they're not going to make money. So I don't want them to pay me for a course, obviously.
I have a little radical idea to drop in, just a thought that I've been
Yeah.
having. In different cultures, some things can be sold and bought for money, and other things can't. Prostitution is like a great example. Some cultures say, yeah, do whatever you like. Other ones say, no, that's absolutely forbidden. There's a sacred or consequential, negative impact of that becoming something that you can just buy and sell. Buying and selling people for like slavery or children. Like, there's all of these prohibitions. And it made me wondering if there could be a social niche for crops that are grown in this very special way, that they're not just compared on a supermarket shelf to something that was produced with a machine and diesel and chemicals, that it is a categorically different thing, and that in producing it, it could have a significance in a culture that means, no, this is not for sale. I was thinking of doing this with like, if I breed a really good local melon that smells amazing, that I could actually take it to the market and say, no, nobody can buy this. You have to convince me to give it to you.
Yeah, this is what I do. I like to wind people up. They come and they see all my baskets and this and that. Oh, is it for sale? I think, no, it's not for sale. You've got, but I'll show you. What interests me is showing somebody how to get it themselves. So, obviously, your melon, what would be really interesting is its seeds were agreed, because if somebody could get the seed, then they could, and they don't need 100, they just need, if you're a good gardener, they just need one or two. But it's a great idea, but it's not a financial idea. That's
No,
the
no, no, no. Well, I almost think of like the communion wafers, that you don't just buy them by the kilo with the supermarket. They're imbued with a sense of significance, and they have a ritual like place in the community. And I wondered if there were more people like you creating, a small surplus and a community around this form of cultivation, you could actually make that something that you come together and produce a shared product, that the only way that anybody can access it is to, participate in that community. It isn't just something that's up for sale.
Yeah, well, I think that my sur I've just, since the past sort of 10 years, I've had a surplus, and the way I've decided I want to share it is with my training courses, with my, which are free, but I can afford, I can afford for them to be free because I've got a surplus to share with the people that come. So obviously, the trainee's going to come, and they're going to, be useful and grow a bit of, help grow a bit of cereal, but it's going to take a year for that crop to get to maturity. So during that year, the people that the trainees can eat my surplus, and then the year after they're going to be eating what the but I think that community it is the final key to a self-sufficiency, isn't it? To be self-sufficient by yourself is kind of sad. But to be self-sufficient with other human beings is joyous, and it's also radical because you're helping to impact, aren't you, wider than just yourself. So yeah, I think I've got the same idea.
It's interesting the approach you're taking, because there's two questions I want to ask. Firstly, do you know of anyone who has taken your book and have started to go down this path themselves? Are there people out there who occasionally send you a question? It's like, I wasn't sure, how do I deal with this? Do you know if that's already happening?
Yeah, I have a theory that the people that do the most farming communicate the least.
Yes. Okay.
So,
So
perhaps my best student, well, hasn't contacted me yet.
the other thing I want to ask you about is if you know about the history of Fukuoka, the one straw revolution guy in Japan.
Yeah, I'm a fan. He's
Yes.
my
But do you know about the end of his life? Like
where he
the
had students.
well, yeah, he had students for many, many years, but the last bit when he was winding down, I read somewhere that he came to believe that his life was a complete failure because people weren't. Well, a really good example, one of his students who worked beside him and in his system for many, many years, ignored his teacher's advice and went to another part of Japan and tried to replicate the model, like just to copy it.
Yeah.
And he said, no, I discovered this method for this place through this long process of observing and interacting and testing what could actually function here. And you're going to have to go through the same process no matter where you go. And he told this to all of his students, and it's in his writing if you look for it. But the thing people came away with is, oh, seed balls and no work. And it's like, no, that's not it. That's not it. You're getting the wrong message. There's so much more that's demanded of you. And if you try and take a shortcut, you're probably going to be disappointed. And yeah, I'm sure I saw it somewhere that he felt like he failed to get that across. And
I think you
I'm
really,
wondering if you're mindful of that.
that is such a fantastic thing you said to me there, because I just, all these people that come, because I work with a hoe, and people just keep coming to me and saying, oh, I don't, my hoe, I don't want to cut up the worms and I don't want to work the soil and Fukuoka. And actually, I'm a huge fan of Fukuoka, but I only discovered it once I discovered my hoe. So I don't know. When I read his book, it was just like, wow, somebody else have been through the same thing as me, I couldn't, I just felt so much less alone. But and yeah, but yeah, you really understood that, and very few people understand that about Fukuoka, that he just had a link with his soil, and that's what you need to get. That's what you need to get from his book, is understand your soil, and and not apply a theory. And I have to just, I'm just, I just have to appreciate that, because I think I've had, of all the people that have visited me, I've had hardly anybody that's had that understanding you've just had there. But it's just a terrible trap. As soon as you put something down in words, people, they just, I mean, I get these people writing back after having read the book, and I can see, and it's true, it's in there, the little thing is in there, and they're just taking it, for me, they're just taking it too literally. But it is a kind of, I mean, to me, yeah, okay, that's for Fukuoka, but if you look for me, any of the great scriptures, all the religions are the same thing. People are just taking the words and not understanding them, and putting something together in their lives that isn't worthy of the great text, But it's and so it's a big question. Do I just n don't transmit, and nobody can misunderstand what I say, or do I speak and write, and it's going to be completely misunderstood, and people are going to hate me in the future? And I think that's a really good question. What's a better model?
I
But I do.
think, well, I think it goes back to the tragedy of what was lost during industrialization, because every little farm with their own patch of peculiar soil had gone through a process, a hard-won process of figuring out what they could actually do with it. And I mean, permaculture tries to do this, but you can see the same thing. Like the very roots of permaculture, that message was very clear. And then you fast forward decades and it's like, oh, you just put down cardboard and, that there you go. That's going to solve all your
Yeah.
problems. Or swales, it'll solve all your problems. And it's like, no, that's just two of the easier to understand and communicate techniques out of a really wide range of things that may or may not work in any particular place, in any particular combination. And you always have to keep going back to first principles whenever you, I mean, like for you and me, for example, what progress we have managed to make. If you had to move to a completely new patch of land, even like a relatively short distance away, you would have some advantage over somebody who knows nothing, but you would probably also have to unlearn a few
Yeah.
things that became habits in your current place.
Yeah.
And yeah, I don't know. That's
I
a
mean,
kind of
I think
open-ended thought.
I no, but I obviously I can I'm just convinced that whatever I say is going to be misinterpreted and applied in a wrong way, and everyone else around that knows I'm going to think, that's a really rubbish book, that because look at this person, so arrogant, thinks they know everything from that book. But at the same time, you do. I think there are certain principles, like I think the zero input is a fantastic principle, and you just sort of think, I can't see how this could be like misquoted or misrepresented, because zero input is just seems a really great guiding principle for farming.
And you only have
And
to tell people, look at a patch of unmanaged land in like anywhere that isn't a desert or tundra, and the amount of growth and vegetation of weedy wild species that happen to find their way there, like the amount of life that the land wants to produce, that's a hint about what's possible if you have the right plants with the right technique, and you can
yeah.
achieve something. Maybe not quite as easy and abundant, but more, it's a compromise with human needs, basically.
And yeah, so I think you're important. I think the hoe is a great tried and tested tool, because you find it in Neolithic times. You can strap a stone to a stick and whack the soil. It doesn't have to be like a big metal hoe, but you find it across the whole world. And so I think that's another good basic thing. But
How do you think you'd go if you didn't have any metal tools? Like if you only had the ability to make fire and I guess wooden and local stone? I mean, this is a really like it's a more extreme thought experiment, but have you thought about
oh, I wouldn't do it, because I'm not
that?
really trying to that was what I did with, when I was 20, I was like in that mentality of hating everyone and everything and wanting to do it just right. Now I can see that it's not, it's about, it's just about being a, you're a living person in your time, sadly. I'm not, and actually, I see what, the feedback I get from people, they're actually, they're thrilled, they're thrilled that, they want to know how I mill my flour. So when I've got an electric mill, because I straight, well, I could have, I could have spent like a couple of thousand euros or 4 or 5 thousand euros on a mill. But then, what message is that, when I could have carved myself a stone mill, but I would have probably taken a year over it. And I'm not going to make another one for someone else. So is that really what I'm preaching? And then you've got sort of nuclear energy coming down into your, into all the houses these days. And you can get a mill for, relatively cheap. And it seems that that's actually more inspiring than just trying to go for this complete extreme, which nobody's going to follow. And, but yeah, we used to, apparently, just 40 minutes away, We used to be one of Europe's axe stone axe capitals.
Oh,
It
wow.
was a stone axe factory, Neolithic stone axe factory, made out of dolerite, stone called dolerite B or something. So I could just go over and carve myself out an axe.
The funny thing is, if you look into like even that Stone Age technology, it was still a very specialized and networked technique. Like it wasn't everyone who was going out and making their own stone tools. There would be particular locations with good resources, and then particular skilled people are really good at making tools, and then there were networks of trade. It was in some ways very similar to even the pre-industrial agriculture with like iron tools. So I think people have to be realistic about how much they try and take on to solve and figure out just on their own. And that's
I
why
know,
sharing what
but
we do is so important too.
people just want to be the best, don't they? I think a lot of people that get into a small holding is that they want to be, they're having an identity crisis and they want to find their niche and that they want to be the best. And maybe live on courses or something, but to me, it's just not authentic. I can see it's a trap to go into, but it's not authentic because you can only, we're all the best at feeding ourselves, aren't we? You can't be better. I can't be better than my neighbour at feeding himself. He's going to have to feed himself in the way he can do it. And
I think that's why it's really important that you pick one thing that's your focus. And for you and me, we have that in common. It's zero input. Like, what can the land actually grow without bringing it, like even bringing in like truckloads of mulch, thinking that it's, sustainable. Nobody would do that much biomass processing of that particular material over those distances just to grow a few lettuces. And yeah, really forcing yourself to solve that problem with a mind that one day people in the future are going to be forced to solve that problem, and not feeling like you have to solve all of the problems as just one person. I think that's a really important thing to decide, like what's the thing that you really want to focus on figuring out yourself. And then once you know how to do it, you can share that with other people.
Exactly. And I think for my I just needed the first step, really. I'm taking a first step. I think if everybody was farming, zero input farming, I might be a hunter gatherer. I might be a hunter gatherer. I think I'm not a particular, I'm not I don't think farming is the best way. I think farming has perhaps been the start of all our troubles. Because it's been too efficient, and the tragedy is, I don't think I could live in where I live without farming. I think it was, and if I wanted to just herd, I'd have to be a multi-billionaire and own sort of tens of thousands of acres. So I've got, but I do think that it's been a long hu human history. Really, has been a long, sad story, and I'd like to go back, I think I'd like to go back to back home, like to go back all the, I think you look at the animals and you think they must be, I mean, they're just happy. You can see they're happy. They don't have the same social weights as us. And I think we could, I do believe that we were similar one day, once. And I'd like, I just see mine's the first step. If everyone was doing what I was doing, I'd be continuing the path back, back to who we are. But you can't, you have to be practical. And if you really want to get close to nature in this lifetime, you've got, it's not just a fantasy. You've got to do what you can do where you are.
I
And so
mean,
I think that's,
my big position is that the crops that you have available have certain demands and requirements and logistics, and that shapes the societies that are built on top of them. So like a really good example is when the potato came into Europe. It completely changed the dynamics of like taxation for peasants and caused all of these different like changes. And industrialization came on the top of that, and kind of we never got to see the end of that particular story. But I don't know. My hope is that this time, this big disruption in history is this big kind of mixing pot that might put new crops and livestock in the hands of different groups of people around the world. It possibly like completely new domestications. That's my hope that we've still
Which
got.
will it would be fine, but it wouldn't be better. This is what I, obviously, this
Well,
is what
what
I
about tree crops? Like they take a lot longer to go through a full domestication process, and the logistics and dynamics of like forests that can feed people rather than fields that need all of this labor. It might be something that hasn't happened yet, but is still possible. Just like potatoes didn't emerge spontaneously in Europe, but once they arrived there, they worked.
I know that. I mean, potatoes are a shit crop because the seed degenerates, and you have to keep buying. The seed gets viruses, and you need to keep. They grow the seed potatoes in the north where they don't get the aphids or whatever. So, and then they grow them on. I think Brittany. The growth like the first year. There's a band in Scotland and parts of Scandinavia, I think, and then they grow them on, multiply them to it, and then. But if you save your seed and replant it, the potatoes get smaller and smaller in the current system with the current varieties. So that's something I input. That's one of my inputs is I buy a bag of seed potatoes every sort of 2 or 3 years. And which with cereal crops, you don't need to do that. So at the same time, you're thinking, okay, potato. I mean, at first there was potato blight. Now they've got more blight-resistant varieties, but I think there's a big question mark over the potato and whether it's going to be with us for the next, just to be pedantic.
But I mean, but it's an example of like how different crops can be, and that we've just got this relatively small set of crops that we accidentally domesticated thousands of years ago. We've just kind of been running on those few inventions. And yeah, I mean, I'm kind of plugging my own work here, but Taming the Apocalypse is basically an exploration about all of the other things that we could domesticate. While we've got this kind of moment in the sun that we can afford to do all of these crazy experiments in a way that our pre-industrial peasant farmer ancestors couldn't afford to take those chances, and they didn't have the tools and technology that we have now.
Yeah, I often think that if the whole colonial, if the whole discovery of the New World had just limited itself to a few friendly exchanges of vegetables, it would have, we could have given them, wheat and rye, and they could have given us, they've given us beans and,
And maize and cassava,
and. Why couldn't it have just been like that? Why did it all have to get so sort of
Mixed
brutal?
up,
Brutal, And if it just stayed like that, it could have been a very nice little chapter.
Well,
But yeah, you do.
that might be what the post-industrial world looks like, just the occasional ship drifting around and saying, we've got these seeds, you've got those seeds, and we know our climates are similar. That's why we came here.
That would be nice.
What have you been
That would
working
be
on for the
nice.
last 1,000 years?
But yeah, sometimes I think, I mean, that would be the nice scenario. And the non-nice scenario would be that even though we've got these really good crops, which are quite, not so sure about potatoes, but beans and squashes, they grow really well here. And we just become so stupid that we could just lose everything, all the good, as well as all the bad, we could lose all the good as well. And because when you look at the farming skills of people, you think, well, if they, if there's any problem in it, what would, could anybody grow anything? Would we just lose all these crops we've got? That would be, that would be the bad scenario to the whole. But I know people go on about new crops, but I sort of, sometimes I think if I just had some oats to eat, I'd just be ha just had oats and leeks, I'd just be happy. Do I need more? That's another question, do I really need more? And okay, well, maybe I could have a crop that could allow me to live in a place where I couldn't live before, so I could have more kids. That would be fun. But why? Why? What's the why not just focus on one or two simple things that are good enough? And enjoy that rather than always trying to look for something else, but yeah, that's just my I used to try
I
not.
know where you're coming from, and again, it's another thing where I'm I admire that you have that focus. And I go through cycles. I'm of like trying lots of new different things and then realizing that it's impossible to manage them all. And a lot of them, I gave them a few chances and they just weren't good. So I go through occasional, I'll dig into all of the seed boxes behind me and I'll be like, nope. Narrow it down to what I know actually has proven itself. And there might be a few things that I'll give them a couple of extra chances, but they're on their last legs. And it's an exciting but potentially exhausting kind of process to go through.
But have you actually succeeded in, could you feed yourself, do you think, on
So
your land?
the grain crops here are very hit and miss. I have a tuber crop that is from old Peru, the canna. It's kind of related to bananas, but it's got a big starchy tuber on it. And I've managed to hybridize them into a really vigorous form. So we wouldn't starve. Like we've got stable year-round calories in a crop in the ground that the pests don't touch. It's not
And do you get enough
particularly,
of it?
I put like an acre of it, but it needs a bit more breeding work to improve it. It's kind of halfway back to wild to give it
So
some
it's
vigor back.
edible, but it's not your favorite thing.
No, it's not the kind of thing I would ever choose to eat. And it's funny, like the early days of agriculture in Mesopotamia, I think the wheat was like the last thing that you wanted to eat. If there was a gazelle or fish that you could pull out of the stream, it was always that was the best option. And if there was nothing else left, you'd have, you'd spend the day grinding wheat rather than starving. I see a lot of the crops that I'm developing here are basically when the goats are producing milk, when we've got a spare goat to put in the fire pit, that's the first choice. And then if there's nothing else left, if there's a bad month, you can fall back on these starchy tuber crops, which are better than absolute starvation.
Canna is
Yeah,
called.
yeah. I think it's grown as an ornamental in Holland. It's got like big ornamental purple leaves and pretty yellow or
Okay.
red flowers. The Dutch have managed to fill them with viruses by cramming them into greenhouses.
It's not a drug, though. Can the
No,
Dutch got it without me?
no. When
You got it, that can
you
cram
often
more drug
Google
into a
search and it
crop.
tries to tell you to look at marijuana and like, no, it's a different thing. But yeah, that's the one I think I've made the most progress with, and the local tree crop, which functions a bit like chestnuts, but some years you get a massive crop and you don't know what to do with it. This year we got none. So again, it's a bonus that if you can manage the populations, you don't need to do any more work than harvesting it, but you can't rely on it 100%.
You can store it there, I imagine.
For a while, you have to process and dry them. They're a bit like chestnuts in the warm weather, they can rot quite quickly.
Chestnuts don't store well. No, hazelnuts. We have hazelnuts here, and they're amazing. They can store for years and years.
It's too warm for hazels here, but we do have macadamias. They were domesticated from wild species, like just up the road from here.
Yeah, macadamia is a great man. Bought me back some once, and
Yeah, they're lovely.
the thickness of the shell is crazy. It's like,
When you've got parrots flying in from by the thousands, then it's amazing. You put up with having to break the
that's what I
hammer.
was thinking. That's what I was thinking because it's a heavy duty shell, for the Australian wildlife.
Exactly. It's an
Walnuts would just
advantage.
get ripped to pieces, wouldn't they?
Yes. Well, pecans grow really well here, but we only have the paper shell genetics, and they have no chance against the birds. Absolutely none.
Yeah.
We should probably wrap up, but I've been having so much fun. I hope I haven't taken too much time, but the final question I love asking people is, what is your vision for the future of food in your community?
Well, you can see I'm quite, my ideal vision.
Let's end on a
I
hopeful
mean,
note.
I'm quite a pessimistic person, really. And yeah, I think obviously people are going to get my book and they're not going to do it the way I think they should do it. They're just going to be too analytical and it's not going to work. And so I'm not really thinking I'm going to change the world for a better place, thanks to my books, But I think that if, I think, the future, if there is a future, is subsistence gardening. Of yeah, you could exchange a surplus with other subsistence gardeners, and I think my future is yeah, I definitely want to. I think ideally it is to make myself into a training center, a full subsistence gardening, which is free. And because I think really you can't really a subs you can't really be a subsistence gardener by yourself, because people have always done it in a community. And it's one of the contradictions of the whole thing, really. But can't do it by yourself. But the way society is made, that communities don't really work if you try them. And that's why I think I'm going to choose more of a training school model rather than a resident community, because I think a resident community, people start fighting each other, and the focus goes off the land onto politics. And but yeah, I mean the reality is it's the farms are getting bigger, and knowledge is still getting lost here. There are still some old people that remember the way things were done, and they're still dying. So I think people are still quite excited with the new gadgets in reality. But then you get it, there's a countercurrent of urban people moving in, but then they don't know anything about farming, so
It's surprising how highly skilled and difficult to transmit the package of little things that you and I are kind of stumbling into. It's not the kind of thing someone can just turn up and look at the garden and really understand what you're doing, but it takes like a little bit of nudging every day to get a successful result.
But no, I think seeing that we've got the technology, it's great to be able to network with people around the world. I think that's like something I definitely want to be doing, is network with other people, using the modern technology. I think the modern technology is great. I like Instagram. People like to criticize the social networks, but I think when you've got it, you should use it, and you should use it for a good cause, a Facebook, Instagram, and all the technology, to be able to, because I think machines are powerful, but people are, people together, we're more powerful, aren't we? That's the thing. And that's what people can't do, really, is work together. But if we could pull together, we could create a bit of a movement. I think your name of zero input farming, I think it's a great, catchphrase, because it's simple. Something that people could really, take up. Because, so yeah, quite positive, really. I'm pessimistic, but positive in my own life.
I would say you have a very realistic grasp of the challenges ahead. And for me, that's the sign of somebody who has their own hard-won successes, that you understand the costs and the rewards that come with going down this kind of path. And for many modern people, it's almost unimaginable. But I hope, like me, you get a lot more support, like people who are trapped in the suburbs that have jobs and mortgages and commutes and traffic jams and all that kind of stuff. I think more and more they understand the value of what people like you are doing. And I'm hopeful, and this is why I do this podcast, is to get that awareness out. And selfishly as well, like I love the chance to talk to people like you. It makes it
Same
all
as me, yeah.
worthwhile.
We're actually quite selfish, but no, I do think that the main thing that puts people off from this idea of leaving the town and having a farm is that they're going to be alone. They just, think they're going to be lonely. And I think if there was a, if they thought it was other people doing it, and it was a fun club to be part of, I think you'd get a lot more people doing it, and the people that were doing it would stick at it longer. Rather than just quit after a couple of years, because and I think that that's one of the advantages of the social media, is that even though you might not have, your neighbors might not be doing it, you can be talking to other people doing it, and it's even exchanging things in the post and everything, and it's good fun.
I suspect that how there was the kind of 1970s Back to the Land movement that kind of fizzled
Yeah.
for the most part. And if you look further back in the 1800s, there was one as well that went through a similar thing, trying to build communes and go back to farming, and
Yeah.
that mostly failed as well too. And I'm hoping that people like you and me are kind of sowing the seeds for a third try at this, and people won't be so naive this time around, or at least as naive. They might still be a bit naive, but this might be the time that we give people the actual realistic tools to have a fighting chance to make it work. If there's groups of, I'm hoping young people in particular could look at the opportunity of like escaping from suburbia and cities together with the right selection of people and the right understanding that it's not just going to be a walk in the park. There are there's an adaptation process, but young people I think are better at going through those kind of redefinitions.
No, I definitely think they should. I think they should try it. You should be brave in your in life. You should be brave and should try it and you stick at it and it'll work. You know, that's my experience. It doesn't work at the beginning because all your ideas are wrong, but that's the joy of it. And if you stick at it, it will work and you'll become a philosopher. You might not get a lot of food, but you'll be surrounded by beautiful bird song. This is what I tell people. You know, you're just judging my success by my food, but I've got lots of birds, and they're thanks to all the food that I've grown and they've eaten. And I'm living in a paradise. And because I've got so much nature around me. And basically, it's all thanks to me having slaved away like a dog, you know, growing stuff for them. But then people pay for music to listen to music and stuff, and I don't need to. I get free bird song. And all singing, thank you, Samuel. You know, more food, please. We're looking forward to next time you plant those seeds. But you know, every year I've had enough to eat. I haven't had all the crops. I haven't harvested all the crops I've planted. But I've always harvested something. I've always had enough to eat. So I was saying you've got to keep perspective on what you want overall. Not get focus on getting 100% of your grain crop. You know, just enough seed to plant the next year. And enjoy it, you know, enjoy it, enjoy the journey with all the animals. They're le much less crazy than people.
Well, on that amazing note, do you want to make a final plug for where people can learn more about you, where to get your book? I'll put the links in the show notes.
It's Ho Farming. They can go to the website hofarming.com, ho hyphen farming.com, and dig me out and bother me with questions. I've still got lots of time to apply to people, so I'm still having fun. I haven't employed anybody, so it's still me.
But before you become a rock star like Fukuoka was at his peak in the 70s when everyone latched onto him, hopefully. I'll also look around YouTube. I found a few documentaries, short documentaries of people who came out to see what you're doing. I'll pick a few out that I think work really well to put in to so people can learn more
Great.
about you. But yeah, thank you so much, Samuel, for taking the time to chat with me, for all of the work that you've done and shared. I think I had the same kind of experience. As soon as I found you, I'm like, here's somebody who's on the same path as me and younger than me, but already, I would say, in many ways, much more successful than what I've managed to do. So it's been an inspiration to learn about you.
Yeah, I think it's been one of the most or the most intelligent interviews, you know, I've ever had. That's because you're a farmer, I can tell it.
I know all of the tricks. The Zero Input Agriculture Podcast is a solo passion project built with my ample time and meager resources. If you would like to support the show, then sign up for a paid subscription to my Zero Input Agriculture blog at Substack. As a reward, you can read all my past posts and listen to the audiobook of Taming the Apocalypse. If you prefer reading about the past and future of biological technology, you can read the ebook of Taming the Apocalypse through Amazon. And finally, please rate and review the show on whatever podcast app you use, since it helps other people find me, or recommend the show directly to anyone who could use some inspiration to become a plant breeder themselves.